Midnight to Midnight. Welcome. Screening. Welcome to Midnight Screening. Welcome to Screening. Welcome to Midnight Screening. I am screaming. I am screaming.
I am screaming.
Hello and welcome to Midnight Screening, where we let you stay up past your bedtime with the movies you probably shouldn't be watching. I'm Noah Jansen. I'm here again with Darcy Eagle. Thank you for joining again, Darcy.
Hello. I don't know if anybody heard, but it's cracked my neck. Apologies if that came up on the thing.
Heard a neck crack.
Okay.
They're probably hearing lots of other things
yes.
as well, because there's a third character with us for this episode today. This very special episode. That third character is New York City, the Big Apple herself. We are currently away and we are like, we knew we'd get a bit of ambience recording out in the wild, but we're recording from Central Park and
it's a Saturday.
And as we've already talked about in the US, like there are literally people will speak in a way that you're like, that feels like a skit or something.
It feels like the vine that they were roommates. That's what every situation is. You hear like a clear sentence from somebody's conversation.
Like every 5 minutes, literally. We're watching two separate games of baseball being played in this like public park and people are playing frisbee and there are little squirrels everywhere. We're fully cosplaying as New Yorkers. And with that cosplaying as New Yorkers came a chance for me to indulge this hyperfixation of mine of film, being that there are so many iconic cinemas throughout New York. At any time of day, we can literally just be like, oh, do you feel like seeing something? And then like catch a train and you'll see one of like the best movies you've ever seen in your life. And I watched a film a few months ago, a documentary made in 2002 called Cinemania. And Cinemania followed these like four or five New Yorkers who all essentially their life, like either they have inherited a huge amount of money or they're on like, you know, disability or just different ways that essentially their life accommodates them organizing every single day around getting to as many cinemas as they can and seeing as many movies as they can. It's kind of a cautionary tale for my brain type, I think, and anyone that like uses Letterboxd or listens to a podcast like this. So I said to Das, while we were here and we're seeing lots of movies, one day we should do Cinemania Light, I guess, which it's still not that light. We're seeing three movies today, which is still a lot of movies for a very sunny Saturday. And Das very kindly has agreed. Even though, I guess, how much of a choice was there, really? You're a nice girlfriend, so.
Yeah. The only thing that's made it slightly bad on my behalf is that I'm kind of a bit hungover.
We always do it. We're always like, and now the weekend's hit. And then we woke up and an 11 a.m. movie really did feel like the crack of dawn.
God, we do it so hard, being in New York, waking up, see a movie at 11 o'clock with nothing to do, hungover, because we had a really great day.
Brutal, God. Pray for us. I feel like we should crack into our first movie. So we've seen our first movie, so we're going to talk about that now, and then we will be chatting about two more movies before the end of this episode. So let's talk about our first movie, which was Make Way for Tomorrow. So, firstly, I wanted to say that I'm not going to spend too much time on this because we've got three movies to talk about, but I did want to mention a little bit about the cinemas we're going to, because like it's just really exciting to go to these places that have such brilliant programming. And yeah, again, like the culture here of film appreciation is very exciting. So we went to today a cinema we hadn't been to yet called Paris Theatre in Manhattan. It's the longest running art house cinema in New York City. So we've been to like a lot of these little single screen places so far that have specialty programming, but not one that was this big. I was kind of impressed by it. And yeah, it's the borough's largest movie theatre. And I was wondering how it's still open, because I assume it's expensive to run, and got my answer when I found out that Netflix bought it, or like, like operates the theater. Yeah, that started with when Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story came out in 2019, which I think makes a bit more sense.
As in, wait, I'm confused. So Netflix bought it because obviously they had Marriage Story, but what was the benefit of them buying it? I mean, obviously I know Noah is an independent New York filmmaker.
I think it is almost in relation to the fact that we talk about Netflix and streamers as being very like anti-cinemas, and it's almost their way of saying like, no, we do have an appreciation for preserving the cinema as like a unique event experience. So they've, well, you know, not to, you know, the Paris Theatre is still around, so like good for them. But I do feel like, you know, they don't.
We bought one theatre.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, look what we did. Yeah, I think it's a bit of that. But hey, it was a beautiful theatre.
Yeah.
And we saw Make Way for Tomorrow, which was part of their, what do they call it? Like Bleak Week. Yeah, they're showing all these films that are like super fucking depressing, which was a fun way to start a day where we were a bit hungover. But we saw Make Way for Tomorrow, which came out in 1937. It's directed by Leo McCarey, who directed Duck Soup and An Affair to Remember. So mostly worked in directing comedies and silent comedies and stuff. And there was a really great introduction that briefly mentioned essentially this as a big departure for the director and a real passion project. It essentially was him having not midlife crisis, what's it called? He had a health scare and then was reflecting on his relationship to his parents.
His father also died.
Yes. And Make Way for Tomorrow is, it's the story will sound familiar to Tokyo Story, a film that we did on our last podcast, Twin Peaks, in that it's about an older couple and essentially how their children have to like navigate taking care of them, the way that it's just constantly subliminally implied that they are a problem or something. In the, they obviously love them, but that they're always, you know, having to go the extra mile or take care of them or disrupt their plans to look after them. And it's just a huge bummer of a movie about our relationship to growing old and feeling like time has passed you by and how much we older generations and caring for them. How did you find Make Way for Tomorrow, Das?
It's funny because obviously like he made his career mostly doing comedies and silent comedies, and for something that was, you know, allocated to a bleak week, it did have some sort of sense of humour to it, which I'm certain at times if the bigness overall, it was almost like a cautionary tale kind of thing, took away from the sentimentality for me, or if it...
I just didn't find it bleak. Like, the bleakness, of course, was the way that the plot was working around them always being, managed, essentially, or sort of, being, you know... There are different... You know, the first child that they stay with, essentially, they're always trying to get the grandmother... They're trying to get her out of the house because she keeps interrupting their dinner plans or her games of bridge. And, it just feels like she's being babysat. So, like, the plotting of those things was always upsetting. But I actually... The movie ended kind of abruptly for me because I was prepared for such a bleak ending, and it ended on a hopeful note, not in terms of that, like, you think that this couple is going to live another 50 years or anything well, like that. But the in the sense that the victory is their love. The victory is them.
You've not kind of said, obviously, the plot fully in just being like the main actual kind of, I guess, bleak or upsetting part of it was the idea that the mother and father were separated in how they were looking after them. So their house gets sort of taken over by the bank. They have to move out. They have to separate because their kids don't have enough space to have them both. And there's also that fear from all of the, like, four or five kids, that if they take both of them, they're going to get locked into that for, you know, the foreseeable future, obviously. So they're kind of all kind of shuffling them around, trying to, you know what I mean, decide what the permanent state.
And each of the siblings has a moment of sort of trying to, like, pass off responsibility. You know, there's one of the daughters that it's just implied, like, she wants to do the absolute bare minimum, doesn't want to disrupt her life at all, keeps claiming she's about to take them, one of the parents off their siblings' hands for a bit and then doesn't follow through with that. So, that's very true that it's the bleakest part of the film, I guess, the most upsetting part of the film to me was the moment where it's obviously very expensive to make long-distance calls, so they're always just missing each other so much. And then there's one moment where they've gotten the grandma out of the house for the night because they were trying to have a party where they're teaching people how to play bridge professionally or whatever the hell.
It's not a party, it's her business, Noah.
Yeah, exactly.
The mother calls that out.
She does. She's like, that's how I provide the income for the house, to pay for your food, which, like, true. And then the grandma comes home and it's like, oh, great, she's back. And of course, because she's old, she has to talk very loudly on the phone. Again, it has a real sense of humor about it, like like a lot of very, very funny moments. But this loud phone call she's having, just that idea of, like, in the middle of a party of people who are, like, trying to, yeah, be in their own world and be in their own, like, 30, 40-year-old person problems and world. You know, you have a night off, you just want to play a game of bridge. The idea of someone at a later stage of life almost being plopped in the middle of the party, making a phone call where they're, like, trying not to break down. Like, it's essentially just the whole party going silent as she talks about, like, I miss you so much. I'm worried about your health because he's getting sick. I just thought it was a really great case of the film's strongest moments being, like, this quiet dignity that they both have to have in the face of always being not lied to, but, you know, in other people's eyes you are a nuisance, but they also understand that you're just old, you're just elderly, so they kind of all push you aside or just say whatever they can to nullify you. I found that really upsetting in terms of the bleakness of it, but I ultimately found it quite a beautiful ending.
The third act is again, there's actually an interesting kind of, it's not this thing of like, oh, the one thing the kids do is, you know, discard the parents. It's actually this dichotomy that they sort of gets brought up is like, our kids wouldn't be happy if we tried to keep living our own life, or we're trying to, you know, apply for another job or do something that would keep us going through our later life. So they'd be like, oh, no, you shouldn't be working, mum and dad. That's not good for you. That's not right. Yeah. But they also don't want to take them in.
Yeah,
And the mother ends up getting sent to an old people's home. Are we doing spoilers? I mean, I kind of have now, but yeah, you know spoiling. What I mean? We're spoiling. I feel like I'm not sure if this is even really available for viewing necessarily on a wide scale.
I'm sure because it's from the 30s now. You could probably watch it on Internet Archive or something. I would really recommend it, but
I was going to say the third act is actually, there's a challenging point of like, well, they are capable of sort of having their own life. They get to see each other for 5 hours before the dad gets shipped off to LA, sort of to another family member, and little does he know, but the wife has sort of agreed to go to a nursing home. So just, the idea as well that actually they kind of can still have this quite autonomous day after we've seen them kind of be babied in a certain way or treated as a burden or treated a certain way by their kids. They are still people in their own right that can go off and kind of, you know.
And have a super, like, perceptive day. Even just that idea of, like, not only are they seen as not being able to take care of themselves, but equally when they are out in the world, if anything, they're able to savor the city so much more. Like, they have so many, the idea is like they're only supposed to be out for a few hours, but they keep on extending it and extending it because they're having such a good night. And, you know, the city keeps on coming alive for them and presenting them with new opportunities that they can follow. And yeah, for it to end on that note that they're talking about failure a lot towards the end, the idea that he was never super successful business-wise, that she feels she was always so busy raising the children, that, yeah, it's a really beautiful ending, I think, of leaving the audience to say, like, you know what could come next naturally. So the final beat is just the success of, like, you will find yourself at this point in life. You'll blink and next thing you know, you're, you know, 80 and you're reminiscing on the life you've had together and that largely, like, the biggest success of their life has been loving each other. It's just gorgeous. I'm obviously also feeling really romantic in New York with you. So it's just weird to be like, oh, the commitment to another person across decades is really beautiful and really tragic if you had kids that... Well, let's talk about the... I think the movie's pretty fair to the kids in that, like, it's not blankly saying kids fucking hate their parents and treat them like complete shit. It really is fair to, like, you know, it is super inconvenient the way your life would have to shift. And all the little moments where you tell yourself, nah, like, they'll be okay at home by themselves, or like, oh, no, they can, like, each little concession you make in the moment feels acceptable. But it's largely just everyone being too uncomfortable to say the true thing to each other, which is like, either I really need something from you or I'm fully not willing to give this to you. And I think if they were, either party was willing to say that, then it would all probably go a lot differently, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there is the thesis point of kind of being like, why, you know, what is, you know, why do kids feel this way about their parents beyond even just the convenience or non-convenience or financial burden or whatever it is of looking after them? Mm. What is our relationship to our parents? And I was thinking about this of like, obviously it's different for everybody and it depends what your upbringing was like and your individual personalities for sure and trauma and all the rest. But also I think there is something deeply existential about like our feelings towards our parents because realistically it's almost like our relationship to a God in being like, people can have a lot of frustration. I mean, like, that's sort of life in its own way.
No, totally.
That you are like, well, sort of a disdain in this certain sort of sense is towards your parents, the people who brought you into this world. You know what I mean?
I think
you're so, like, your relationship to them is so in flux to your relationship to life itself in a way.
And just how you see your place in that. Like, I thought a lot during it about that thing of, like, children of this era not really knowing how to speak to the idea of, like, how their upbringing placed them within the family, you know? We all have different feelings towards, like, how our family treated us or what our different responsibilities were and stuff. And this film doesn't have as much time to spend on that. It's really about... I think those ideas are inherently in there, but, you know, there are some of the siblings, as we said, feel guilty. I think they all feel guilty, but some of them, the guilt really like, operates how they're acting all throughout the movie. And some of them fully exist in complete denial. They go about their life as normal. They're married to, you know, one of the daughters is married to a man who's fully like, I married you. I didn't marry your mum. Like, your mum's not staying here. Like, that is not happening. And they are just, yeah, completely brushing off any responsibility to the situation.
And one of the kids is just so... like, it's just never discussed. It's always like, oh, well, he's not going to take them because he clearly, like, has no money, no life, no real career. Like, he's just his laissez-faire kind of, like...
It's like Joker guy.
Joker kind of whatever, personality of the family, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah.
I feel like that does exist, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's fair to them all, even though you're kind of disappointed in how they act. And it just made me think about now, like... Oh, what it is to not have the ability to say what needs to be said truthfully to each other. And then what are you really left with when you're almost out of time. Like, the only people who can really meet each other on true terms, where they can say the thing and not be ashamed of what they have to say, are this central couple who can say to each other, we've been happy and we've been sad and I would do it all again. Like, I would always want to be with you.
Well, again, I think the central tragedy is not really the kids' relationship to their parents or parents' relationship to their kids, which is more a Tokyo Story thing, I feel.
Yeah, I agree.
The central tragedy is more that the couple can't be together at the end of their life.
I thought the plotting would be them moving between each of the kids' apartments, like houses, like them being shuffled through like each of the kids.
That probably would have read more comedy, which would have, again, it's almost like there's a hint of that in there. So you're kind of waiting maybe for that kind of plot machination to happen.
I think they mentioned that, you know, because this is a film that's had a real like reappraisal, that there was a talks at a certain point in time of it being turned into a play. And I definitely thought to myself, Darcy, we've been joking that like all the plays on Broadway at the moment sound like the same thing, with like, it's like a Mad Libs like assortment of words of like a family matriarch in crisis between four evictions. Like, all of them are about families and yeah, like the inner turmoil of a family unit once people get older. So I feel like it probably would suit a play, but I agree that the focus of the story is this couple not being together in a really scary and vulnerable part of life, and that inside that, yeah, I think I thought the kids' behavior would feel plotting wise more like them really trying to kick them out or get them out of the house, but what stuck out a lot more was just that quiet feeling of like all the little denials, all the little moments where you can't say the truth or you can't stop and look at yourself in the mirror and say, is this what I want the end of my parents' life to look like? Like, it's happening right now. Is this the way I want to remember it? Or do I want to regret it later and say, oh, maybe I could have found a way for them to live together? Or did we do everything we could do? It's like, yeah, the couple themselves, they're afraid of death and what's coming. But equally, in their denial, it's the kids being afraid of death. Because, you know, what is our relationship to our parents if not the subconscious feeling that they're always going to be there, you know? Like, we can know that we're all going to die, but can we know that one day our parents won't be there, really? Like, you kind of just always know you can call them or they'll be there when you get home or whatever. And it's like, because they're older and wiser, they are aware that, like, this is happening right now, but their kids are trying to treat it like a moment in time. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I think it's the fact that it happens and purposefully in the movie kind of quite suddenly, and I think that it's, you're seeing everybody in really real time having to grapple with sort of some existential concepts, and like a lot of them are really quite quickly pushing towards denial or choosing themselves over sort of the communal aspect of looking after their parents or can't remember what the question was that you even asked me. What do I think?
It was mostly just what you thought on that point there. Orson Welles, that you did. Orson Welles said it was a film that could make a stone cry.
Oh,
and I was very moved, but I didn't cry.
No.
In front of all these people, do you think I'm a good person?
Oh.
That's my question.
I don't believe in good or bad people. I don't really define morality like that, as you know. But,
you heard it here first.
Yeah, heard it here. But I think the thing I was saying at the very beginning was maybe the reason I kind of didn't cry or find it maybe as sentimental. Like, it had all the hallmarks of that kind of, you know what I mean, narrative, and it wasn't overtly emotional, so definitely like the restraint in the, you know, the central couple and the sacrifices they also made to make their kids feel comfortable was the thing that you're like, yep, that was definitely the like tearjerker element of the whole thing. But yeah, maybe it's just the 1930s sort of aspect to me that it felt all laid on a little thick. It starts, I was gonna say, with a a quote from the Bible.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
honour thy mother and thy father. Is that
honour thy mother and thy father.
I'm going to assume it's honour thy father and thy mother because, you know, the Bible.
Yeah, straight up. And we both looked at each other and were like, hey.
Yeah, so if that kind of gives a, you know, indication of maybe how sort of, because of the time laid on this message was, but it is something that I think probably stopped me from actually crying because, yeah, look, if you're a bad person for not crying, so am I, because I didn't cry either, really.
I just thought that the the sentimentality would be in different places. Like, when I was most moved was when I was actually very, like, hopeful, or, like, I thought something was beautiful. It being part of this bleak week season at the Paris Theatre meant that I think I was waiting for a version of bleakness that didn't come. So I guess call your mum and dad. And with that, we'll keep on hanging out in this park, I think, and then we're going to mosey on over to our second film. Thanks, Stars.
Bye.
Bye.
Too much music, no.
Aren't you two forgetting something?
How about channel 27?
Blood pressure of 160 over 80. Heart rate of 88. Normal sinus at this time. Respiratory rate of 18.
Everything is going to be all right. You have only to stay inside. You only have to stay all right. Do not look outside. Do not look outside. Do not need to look outside. Look out, look out, look out, look out, look out.
All right, so we didn't really have enough time between the second and third movie to chat about them. And that being said, since you last heard us speak, two movies later, some Mexican food, some really long...
Scratch the New York ambience thing. We're not doing that anymore. We got back to the apartment. I'm exhausted.
Now we're living the New York City dream.
Fuck that. There's no third character.
Yeah, the third character could die. She died in a ditch. We're laying on our bed in our apartment. And I never thought I would say this, but I don't have what it takes to be a cinemaniac. Like, I'm tired as shit. That was crazy. That was a lot. But that being said, we did see some incredible films and we're going to tell you about them. They were really good. It wasn't exactly the selection that I thought we would be doing initially when I was trying to map out a day, but I loved all of the films and they were all at cinemas I really wanted to go to. So first off, the second film that we saw today, we saw La Vie de Bohème. We saw that at the Anthology Film Archive, which was in the East Village. It was a really incredible cinema, actually. There's a really special history to it that I'd love to look into more. It's a International Center for the Preservation, Study and Exhibition of Film. It has a focus on independent and, like, avant-garde cinema. Clearly a very special, like, hub for preserving film. And this film was La Vie de Bohème, was a French film that came out in 1992, which is going to be, like, a big part of the discussion, I think. It was directed by, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, it's a Finnish name, Aki Kaurismäki, and it's a deadpan tragicomedy about a group of impoverished outcast artists living the bohemian life in Paris. It's loosely based on the famous Henry Murger novel, Scenes de la Vie de Bohème, which has been adapted many, many times, most famously probably in Puccini's opera La Bohème, and also, very New York of us, the hit Jonathan Larson musical Rent. And I would like to first pass this to the group being you, Darcy.
It's just me.
A thing that I think this film did well is, in Rent, which is also adapted from this material, there is a character called Roger, and Roger spends the whole show trying to write one great, great song, one incredible song, and then it gets to the second act, and the song is Your Eyes, and Your Eyes is not only, like, not a, like, great masterpiece song, but, like, it's quite actively a really bad song. And in this movie, you have three struggling artists. One of them's, like, you know, like, they're all struggling artists in their own way, a painter, a, like, composer, and a writer. And the composer, towards the end of the film, he's like, oh, I'm going to play you all my composition. And, you know, they've all been struggling for their art and all of those things the whole movie. And you hear the music that he is disrupting his entire life and making no money in order to make, and it is a, like, ridiculous piece of shit. Like, it's him, like, slamming the keys and banging his head on the keys.
Police sirens. Playing police. Recorded.
Yeah. It's, like, like absolutely
kind of iconic. I'm like obsessed with it. I'm like, yeah, mood. That is what it feels like.
Yes.
You to live your lives, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, well, yeah, he's
I
a real artist.
I agree with what you're saying, that it's a better adaptation because in Rent, they build it up to be like, it's going to be this really amazing, beautiful song.
And we are true artists.
And it's the worst song in the show. Spoiler. Yeah. But in this, it actually is the perfect encapsulation of, like, you get great shots of the girls literally making the exact face that any woman knows when a man plays music for you, where you're just like, oh my God, I am trapped here. And then they just leave. And the next scene is one of them being like, yeah, I'm leaving him.
Like, it was, yeah, exactly my thoughts. Like, I liked this at its most when, in terms of the story content itself, I liked it most when it was not just about, you know, this sort of bohemian life that would be you sacrificing like so much, sacrificing literally your health and well-being. You're not eating, you're living in the freezing cold. You're like never, you never have any money coming in. And when it does, you are really bad with money and you spend it instantly. And it not just being that, like, you know, they are incredible artists. It actually just really being implied, like, yes, there is sacrificing things for your art. And then there's like, are you just a really irresponsible person in the world? Like, there, it's noble to make a sacrifice and you can live how you want to live. But also, like, aren't you just kind of selfish people, or at least very self-absorbed people who then don't really make any efforts to exist in the world or have
I don't know. I found this one better than like actual Rent. I was saying that afterwards. Hilarious.
Oh, the Rent thing is mostly a joke. Like, it's course. A much, much, much better like piece of art
interrogation of those ideas.
Yeah,
than it Rent is.
Yeah, than Rent. Yeah. It's
both
just funny.
Comedically
that,
and tragically, yeah. But yeah. I was about to say, like, it's hilarious because, by the way, did not realize this was like, didn't internalize at all that it was like the adaptation of like the book that Rent was based on. And I was like, do you not think this was exactly like Ren? And Noah was like, yeah, it's based off the same thing. So
when we came out of this, you were hitting goals left, right, and center.
Well,
you were saying,
I didn't know that at all. And I just said that straight off the bat. And you were like, well, yes.
Because another thing that you picked up on, right, that we talked about was, I think while watching it, I was going, have I mischecked that this came out in the 90s? Because it's shot on film. Also, the thing with a film that you're watching that, You know, he's quite a popular filmmaker and all of his films have this idea of, like, the style with which he shoots feels very evocative of, like, particularly this one, very, like, French New Wave. The cinematography is very much, like, the camera is always still. It's always about, like, a beautiful composition, like a lot of shadow and fog.
Deeply edited as well as such.
Yeah, the
like
way it's
missing
cut.
Missing scenes, all of that sort of stuff. Like, it very 1930s kind of, like, you know, pieced together. I didn't even realise this. I got really confused.
But that's what I mean.
When it
like
came out immediately, I was like, was that from the time? Like, I think it does. It's
because its comedic sensibilities are really modern.
Yeah, its biggest achievement is truly that it apes the style really authentically and well. I mean, from my perspective, I don't know enough about French New Wave to ever say that, or I'm not French, so I feel like I'm sure there's discrepancy for people who are like more into that. But personally, I found it really interesting on that level. And even, I guess this is my next question, which I don't know if we want to like necessarily delve into it, but my bigger thoughts were like, the reason it stood out is because, yes, it had progressive moments, honestly, more comedically, as you pointed out, like just the style of the humor kind of suited a more modern sensibility. But that there was like, there were specific scenes in which it sort of outlined the politics and the time that were like relatively misogynistic, but that kind of all led into like aping this certain time and style. Especially the difference between like masculinity and femininity and what those roles were really like clearly outlined in some comedic beats and like some moments of sort of like dialogue. Mm. But then there were also some sort of strange moments where you were like, oh, I'm not sure if this is misogyny in the sense that this is like a style and a time period aping, or if this is just like a director,
male
director in his 90s having like things slip through the cracks where it doesn't do a service to the film. Like, one of the major things, again, I'm like, I'm mostly speaking in the allegory of this is if it were Rent, but I'm like, Roger and Mimi, those characters,
yeah.
they have to, like, there's a central love story, basically, is what I'm trying to say, that you need to believe. And because the Mimi character, she dies at the end of the film, and that becomes this very dramatic, again, tragedy, like comedy tragedy, ends on this huge tragic kind of plot point of her dying. But unfortunately, they really don't build a lot of romance between them. There's this sort of like stilted comedic styling that everything kind of happens in this very blatant way, which I'm on board with. But the initial kind of romance between those two characters just feels like it has a little like layer of misogyny in there, in which you're never really sure whether she's into it. Like, you don't understand why she's into him.
It's the classic like implied love. Like, I totally agree that because... like, firstly, I think what really aids its, like, style and atmosphere is that it doesn't feel like it's existing just in, like, homage as a gimmick or anything. Like, it really authentically uses the, like, even just the, like, film grammar of those sort of, like, older black and white, like, European films. Again, there would be people who could speak to this better than us, but, like, the way those films cut together scene work and the way that characters exist in them really serves this, like, writing and directing, and particularly like the way that he directs the performances, this sensibility of, like, very blunt comedy. Like, it's, to give it, like, a contemporary comparison, I guess, sort of like the Yorgos Lanthimos thing of, like, a very, like, everyone sort of speaks in a similar way. The joke is always in the, like, space after someone said something really weird and disconnected in a way that is me going, like, no, like, more often than not, it is not siding with these men. It's critiquing them, and not in a way that it thinks they're pieces of shit, but in a way that it thinks that they think their cause is really noble, but actually they're really naive. But that sense of... yeah, them all having this really, like, blunt delivery and way of existing does mean that in the third act, the film tries to have quite a, like, sincere...
See, probably, I don't even think it's super critical of them in their naive attempt to navigate the world.
But they fail, like, constantly when they do it.
I know, but I think the comedy is in just the juxtaposition of, like, capitalism and trying to make it as an artist. I think that's where the comedy derives from. And I think at the end, they try and pull off a pretty earnest plot point.
That's my one, is that by...
with them.
Like, outside of... like, whether you think it critiques them or not, the third act is trying to deliver a sincere beat, which I don't mind as an, like, I think as a, like, a writing device, it's quite powerful when something the whole time has said, like, yeah, it's hard to be poor, it's hard to, like, be struggling as an artist to keep up, like, to keep up. And then at the very end, it's like, some, like, poverty has literally taken this woman's life. But because of this film world style where it seems like no one really cares or no one really expresses how they feel, to the extent that sometimes it feels like a joke that you're like, do they not really like each other, or is she just choosing to be with him at the moment but she doesn't really like him, or you really can't tell. And then, as you said, I completely agree, by the end you're like, well, none of the last 20 minutes has worked because, like, I didn't care about her because it really felt like I was being told not to. And I don't know anything about her because the film is really using her as a device of, like, when you're an artist and you are trying to be someone that has relationships, but everything is sacrificed by the fact that if you want to be an artist and poor, there's a casualty to that, which is the people around you.
The commentary it has on that is very, like, it's the very European thing of being like, you know, all I need is my art, you know what I mean? Some food and wine on the table and my girl kind of idea, like, my love. And the idea from the woman's perspective is shown of kind of being like, well, you love your art more than me, or, like, how frequently are you actually prioritizing me and the food on the table versus, like, your art and the thing that sustains you.
There's
I do think, like, there's more commentary than there is in other respects or other adaptations of this, but I still, I don't really think it's at the forefront that they're super critical of these people. Because I think it is a book about kind of the, like, politics of, what it is to try and live as an artist and, you know, what you sacrifice, what you don't. But, as I said, I think it pulls off the comedic side of the comedy, tragic, what's it called again?
Tragicomedy.
Tragicomedy, but the tragic part is a little...
You're talking about my life?
Sorry. Okay. Is that the end of
Thanks, buddies.
Hey, I think that's the end. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, that's just the beginning. No, I'm done.
Okay,
no, I really loved it.
I can't believe they thought they didn't have to pay rent. That's
Reward
City.
Oh, it's so true. Rent just eternally a hilarious text that I'm glad we're allowed to laugh at now. And, you know, good for Rent, but it's kind of wild. It definitely was more critical of them than Rent even pretends to be. But as a film, its last 15 minutes kind of stumped the rest of the things that I was really enjoying about it. But I feel like I focused on the negative. I really loved it and I thought it was great. And we're going to move on to our next film. And then, as if two films in the one day wasn't enough, we walked down to the Metrograph, which was another incredible cinema. It was like just under a 20-minute walk away. The fact that there are all these amazing cinemas so close to each other is just endlessly mind-blowing to me. And it's another really cool, I don't know if it's a single screen, but again, they do like specialty screenings. It had a really great Q&A afterwards with the film's sound engineer and re-recording mixer, Tom Flashman. And the film is Something Wild, which is a film I've wanted to watch for a long time. And I'm really glad I held out for this screening. It was really fun to watch with a crowd. It is a 1986 sort of screwball comedy that goes into like crime film territory, which we'll talk about, directed by Jonathan Demme, most famous for Silence of the Lambs and the Talking Heads music doco concert film Stop Making Sense. And it's about a free-spirited woman played by Melanie Griffith who kidnaps a yuppie for the weekend played by Jeff Daniels. And this was just so much fun, and I feel like it's exactly what we were in the mood for. Like, we watched it in exactly the right space, and I feel like, again, my main criticisms come in the third act conversation, but let's start with what really worked for you. Did you get what you wanted out of this? Were you surprised by it?
It was fun. I think, like, it was just a fun watch. It carried you through some great, like, performances in there as well, I guess, which like intrigued me. I don't know what
we'd recently watched What's Up Doc, which was like the screwball comedy is kind of having a moment like Hit. I haven't watched Hitman yet, but I'm really excited. And Sean Baker's new film that just won the Palme d'Or, that'll I assume be out this year and then probably come out in Australia like early next year or some crap. I think it's called Anora. It means it's really having a moment. I feel like people want these kind of films and that. It, as a style, is the kind of thing that clearly a lot of directors grew up loving and wanting to sort of remake in their own way. But this film really showed for me, like, I appreciated that it was trying to be its own thing inside of that format. Like, it really was kind of not holding itself to anything other than, like, just centering on two extremely charming central performances. Like,
this movie really honors the finance bro and like, you know what I mean? Alternate girlfriend trope.
Oh, and truly just the like a classic origin of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl story.
Which is just all screwball comedy. Really.
Yes, which is just like this wacky girl that's come and completely upset my life.
In a completely unassessed way, obviously. It's the 80s, which is not even the original kind of screwball comedy time period. We're kind of in a mashup here anyway.
Yeah.
But we're not even at the point at all where we're critiquing that trope or kind of giving more space to her as a character.
I think it does the classic
thing. She's
really
a good character, but
by the time that you learn more about her, it feels like the film is humanizing her, but it's actually just sidelining her. Essentially, the first half of the movie is, I love this movie at its best when it was sort of that core idea of like, what is it to like, to break bad? Like, what is it if you just indulged your impulsive thoughts and did the bad thing, which also works at first because you are operating under the assumption that Jeff Daniels is married and has two kids and is indulging in this day where literally he's been at breakfast or lunch or whatever, and someone has like convinced him to get into her car. They've hooked up at a hotel. They've...
off the back of witnessing him skip out on his bill, that he's this sort of person...
who actually has a rebellious streak in him.
Yes. So that kind of idea of, trying to pull out one side of somebody that you kind of witness in them.
And it just creates a fun dynamic initially where you're, like, so charmed because their performances are hilarious, but you know they're both bad people. And, you know, I get that a film
has to be this. I think the second act is really charming too, because we see the reflection. Obviously, the opposite side to that is the fact that we realise she's kind of just picked this guy up because she's on her way home to see her mum and kind of wants somebody she can pass off as her husband, like her new husband, and wants this sort of guy that her mother in part would be impressed by. And then she goes to a high school reunion with him.
It's so
and like,
funny.
So, like, the first and second acts work really well for me.
Me
and
too.
Then we get a little complicated by act three.
Me too, yeah. Like, it's just the classic thing of this sort of film where, like, every time a new location or scene would be introduced, the crowd would laugh before the scene starts because it's this constant heightening of like, oh, she's taking him to meet her mom. Oh, she's taking him to her school reunion. Like every scenario was just like, I was so excited to see the characters navigate it. And again, like I really can't praise, not that I know they're both incredible actors, but like Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith just like find so many hilarious tiny moments. They do like so many of the movie's biggest laughs are just like little inflections or like physical beats that will be them just being hilarious. And yeah, in those first two like major beats of the film, you're just like so endeared by them. And also I was just so excited by the fact that they were bad people. Like it just made it much more exciting that like you got why he was doing it and also were like, well, you're pathetic because, like, you have a wife and kids at home. Then you find out that that is a lie, which sort of lowers that interest point for me. And then Ray Liotta is introduced and he's, like, so sexy and hilarious in the role. He's so good.
He's so great.
And he's being... essentially, it's just, like, he is... it's revealed, like, he's her ex-boyfriend and...
her husband.
Her husband, sorry. He's literally her husband
again,
who's been
see,
in prison.
Like, I don't
been in jail.
Like, I agree with you. It lowers the stakes in a way. And again, the kind of movie fully shifts into a different gear and kind of, even though this is a trope of the screwball comedy to have it all accumulate to this like, you know, massive, you know, big kind of final act. But part of me is like, we kind of accumulate to a different genre, which is that
there's no jokes for like
crime
20
or
minutes.
Kind of action 80s movie kind of energy.
Yeah.
Which, again, I was trying to say, there is something satisfying, I suppose, in part to being like, we start off being like, oh, no, like, he's married and she's his free agent and blah, blah, blah. And it completely flips to be like, well, she's married and he's been left by his wife. So it is. I don't mind the symmetry of that as an idea, but it does, lose stakes when we end up entering a kind of totally different gear.
I also, I completely agree. It feels... in keeping with that idea, I think the third act feels like something built around the idea it represents as opposed to, like, how it supports the audience journey with the film so far. And what I mean by that is, like, this idea of, you know, the music, first off, banger score, like, banger soundtrack, so many great songs. And the most consistent one throughout the film is, like, Wild Thing, or like, you know, it's like Take a Walk on the Wild Side, that idea of like, yeah, what is it to go bad for the day? And then the third act idea with this Ray Liotta character of being like, but you actually can't live here, or like you can't be in this space and be cruel or be possessive. Like, what is it to be people who are like, I walk out on the bill, I do what I want, I go hook up with that, like, you know, that guy, I do what I want. And then a character comes in and he's literally like, I don't care that you're telling me no, you're coming with me. So I get that in theory, it's sort of a like writerly good piece of writing.
Let me just quickly point out, I think the bigger argument point, or again, this is where she gets reduced as a character because she becomes, again, like a plot machination. This is similar to the second movie we watched, where actually I think it's about like whether or not, you know, people have two different sides to themselves, and that kind of idea of like, well, her husband is like, I know her better than you do. And she doesn't want to be happy. She doesn't want to settle down in the suburbs. She doesn't want to have this life. Like, you couldn't satisfy her. It's almost like when you have this wild side to you, like, what kind of life are you going to live? Like, what would you be happy with, if that makes sense? And there's something about kind of like,
when are you indulging something that you needed, and you, when are you just you running away?
To this sort of lifestyle in a certain way, and can you keep up? And like, and actually, does she not want to be respected and loved for who she is? Mm. And, you know, I don't know. There's a sort of back and forth about that sort of stuff. Again, like, she falls a little too hard into that kind of like, you need to help her. You need to see the sensitive whatever woman in her and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But, like, so, he kind of had something to teach her about, like, you know, choosing someone or committing to someone. And you're like, yeah, but, like,
which is fine. It's just, yeah, it's just because, as you said, they kind of abandon her character development by act three.
And just the classic movie thing where you're like, I get that in writing that has to be the final idea, but in plot, couldn't you have kept it a bit funner while you did that? Like, did we have to become a full crime film for the end of it? You know, it's like we always say in Mean Girls, the movie Mean Girls. You're like, yes, the theme of the movie Mean Girls has to be that girls shouldn't be so mean to each other. And also, the film's entire humour is based around that. So is based around people being iconic and quotable. Like, it just does a thing in the third act where, like, by trying to say the, like, yeah, it feels like a very writerly component of it. And I completely agree that it's probably more so around that idea of, like, can you, like, what happens to you if you exist in this sort of mentality or this space forever? Like, what does it do to you? Or what does it take you away from? Sometimes the wildest thing to do is actually to, like, be vulnerable or commit to someone. It just made it less fun for me by that point. But I really, really loved it and was very along for the ride for, like, the first, like, two-thirds of it. Absolutely. Yeah, and again, off the back of the really great Q&A we saw, it was really interesting to hear about, yeah, all the film just being composed of all of these technical magicians whose work, if successful, goes largely unnoticed. That was really cool. So we saw three films across the Big Apple today. We saw Make... Am I going to do this in New York accent? It's happened.
No,
it started.
Oh, okay.
Make Way for Tomorrow. You didn't try hard enough. La Vida Boheme and Something Wild. What was, does any stick out as your favourite? The classic thing of they're all very different films, trying to do different things, but was one of them the top of the heap for you today?
I think Something Wild was just the most entertaining, to be perfectly honest. It's the one out of those three that I would recommend. I honestly don't think would recommend any of the, like, either of the other two to any person I know on my human life. So, you know what I mean? I really enjoyed watching them, but I'm like, they're not a recommend.
I know what
like,
you mean.
Oh, you guys, you should watch this. Like, I'm like, you know, like, obviously watch if you are so inclined. And, you know, you're a person I don't know in my personal life, but I can't imagine them going down with any of my friends.
I completely agree.
And then anyway, so I would say, yeah, top of the heap, Something Wild, what is it?
La Vida Boheme.
La Vida Boheme.
I have had to double check
I would say got
times.
Me thinking the most just for a couple of reasons. And then whatever that first one was, no offense, I guess maybe it was the start of the day, but I really didn't give a fuck about that. You can probably hear from my tone. I was also like not too margarita steep, but I also, I'm not afraid to say it. I didn't like it.
Oh, you didn't like it at all?
Nah, not really. Went to the bathroom for a really long time.
Yeah, you did. You did a piss and I was like,
I don't care.
I was like,
it was like a 1930s. Like, I sound like a like, film, but I more just mean I've watched a lot of 1930s black and white films that I love. And I really was like, it felt a little too preachy for me and a little too of its time. Like,
the main idea that I agree with, well, I guess I can best segue to this by saying that very ironically and very, like, as it usually works out with us, the funnest of the day and the one that best suited my mood was Something Wild. And it's also the one that I would recommend to people the most. But of the three, my favourite was Make Way for Tomorrow.
I really enjoy...
Just a second. Let me speak my case. Sometimes I make shit up, but very genuinely, La Vida Boheme and Something Wild were films that both, like, achieved things really, really effectively and also had, like, large patches that I was like, oh, this isn't working at all or is a bit of a mess. Whereas Make Way for Tomorrow, like, I love golden age Hollywood things for very, like, ultra sentimental, very like, not simple, but very like clear,
but it was
heartwarming message. The thing that I agree, with Make Way for Tomorrow that we talked about that I totally agree with is that thing of like, it's speaking pretty plainly to like, we should respect the generations above us more, and doesn't really have the time or like the capacity or understanding to kind of like think about the like how the kids might feel about how they were raised or how they might have turned out as they are. You raised a really good point when we were talking about it outside of recording that it like even if there was just a question about how the two like grandparents in Make Way for Tomorrow, how they treated their parents, even if there was like a passing moment that was sort of assessing like, isn't it natural that our parents unconsciously a part of, you know, existing and growing up is that they make mistakes and they might hurt us and in our own small ways, like we're affected by them or our relationships to them are based on that. But that as a result, we still, you know, have a service to them. But Make Way for Tomorrow has to pretty plainly be like, these two people deserve better and the way they're being treated is not justified. I think there is nuance in terms of like how it happens in the movie, but I do agree that like it is very much a 1930s perspective on that idea. I just thought for what it was really beautiful and really perfectly well made. I thought it was exactly what it had to be.
Introduced. I mean, of course, I'm asking way too much from a 1930s movie. I think the best way to put it is when you maybe find something an interesting topic, it's cool to watch somebody's reflection on it. You know what I mean? Now, like, you know, 100 years ago kind of vibe. Right? Like when you're heading towards that territory. So you're like, it's interesting to see, but it then does sort of hit a little shallow for some of the ways that we now reflect on those issues.
Totally.
Even the fact that it was sort of like, this really in a way should be sort of like a argument for social security or the fact that we should like, you know what I mean? Like ageism and all of those things like societally and that sort of stuff. But it definitely is not that, considering this person's politics, specifically the person who directed it, but instead does put 100% onus onto the children. It doesn't have any bigger questions beyond truly the honour thy father and thy mother from the Bible, which, again, I think would hit a lot closer. We're not in the position, either of us, to be, like, in a very earnest reflection, like, sentimental reflection.
Without a relationship to those ideas.
We have parents that are, both of our parents are, thankfully, like, alive. And, you know, we're not in a position where they're aging to the point that we're, like, having to reckon with that day in, day out. So I wonder how that would hit somebody going through that more presently.
Yeah.
But to me, it just felt a little bit too simplified and trite.
I totally hear what you're saying.
And it didn't hit those emotional beats for me. I didn't feel sad for them.
I felt I didn't think that I would be more moved to cry happy tears than sad tears. I thought that the day that the older couple spent together as the finale of the movie was like such a beautiful idea. I really loved it. I do think that Tokyo Story, which, by the way, when we said it was the like Make Way for Tomorrow was the template for Ozu's Tokyo Story, he literally watched Make Way for Tomorrow and was like, I am making a film that expands on this idea. I think Tokyo Story is the superior exploration of the ideas in this film, probably. But it was, the film of the day that I think was most, like, top to bottom, exactly what it set out to be. I loved all three of these films. I loved traipsing around New York City with you like I do every day, even though our feet get tired. And I just continue to be blown away by all the amazing stuff that you can see at literally any given moment in New York City.
It's thank cool. you. It's a cool culture. Oh, it's,
and like every time we've gone.
Appreciation as well. It's just the fact that all the cinemas actually have people in them.
They're all like packed screenings. They've all, like almost every film we've seen so far has been like projected in film. And like so many of them have had introductions or Q&As afterwards. It's not something I've yet experienced before at this level. It's very special. So thank you to the Paris Theatre Anthology Film Archive and the Metrograph. And yeah, there's so many other amazing places that we're going to check out. MoMA, Nighthawk. We've been to the Film Forum a bit already. There's truly endless stuff to do. And sorry if you're listening to this back home in Melbourne. I don't know. Hopefully you get to come here at some point as well. Just get ready for the exchange rate because it's going to kick you in the dick. We definitely weren't. Well, I wasn't. I wasn't ready for that exchange rate, but you were doing pretty well.
Oh, look, I just don't want to think about it.
Thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, all of those things. Become a patron of the show over on Patreon. And yeah, thank you so much for listening to this very special New York edition of Midnight Screening. We are going to pass out. Bye.